We're here.
You ready, Debbie?
Yep.
Thank you. The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. I hope that each of you are happy to be here today. We're sure glad to see all of you. If you would please take out your cell phones and turn them all the way off, not just to vibrate, but actually not just to silent, but actually to off. It interferes with the sound system if there are phones that are operating. I wanted to just take a moment to introduce you to Kevin, who is going to be the administrator for our committee. Say any words of introduction of yourself?
Well, no, just happy to be here. And if anyone needs any help, staff members or people in the audience, please feel free to give me a call. So,
thank you, and welcome to our committee. We're going to do the order of the agenda slightly different than it's listed here today. We are going to start with the informational hearing, then we're going to move to House Bill 2518, and we'll come back to 2362 last on the agenda. And are there any questions from the committee before we move forward? Great, then I will open an informational meeting on talented and gifted programs, and I would invite Margaret DeLacy, Morgan Allen, and Stacy Figgins to the dais.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Welcome, Margaret. And if for the record you just state your name.
My name is Margaret DeLacy. I live in Portland. Do you want my address?
No, that's okay.
And I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted.
Welcome.
Thank you. I would like to thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee for holding this hearing. It's a very important and very neglected part of our education system and really needs some of your time and attention. I want to start. You have in front of me what I plan to say today. I'm not going to read it. And you also have some additional materials that evidently didn't make it through the system. So if you feel like you're missing something, would you please let me know? I can email you whatever you'd like to see.
And colleagues, if you're looking for Ms. DeLacy's testimony, it's on the second page that starts with the title Information for the House Education Committee.
That's correct. Thank you very much. I'm just going to run through an outline today. I'd like to start by giving you a little bit of an overview of our Talented and Gifted program in Oregon. Our state law, and it is a state mandate, requires us to identify students in the top 3% in mathematics, in reading, and in general aptitude. There's also a provision that requires districts to identify students who have the potential to be in any of those areas. Somebody's calling me, I think. We have approximately 42,000 students identified as talented and gifted in the state of Oregon. That's the percentage in districts varies from a high of about 11% to a low somewhere probably south of 7%, depending on the district and how aggressive it is with identification. A lot of people believe that talented and gifted education is elitist. That's really not the case. Talented and gifted education provides opportunities for students, often of very modest means, to rise into the middle class, to make a decent income, and to contribute to our economy. There's absolutely no evidence, and this has been studied pretty exhaustively, that providing programs and services to these students in a manner that's appropriate to their educational need does anything to make them into elitists or to think that they're better. The evidence, in fact, is the other way around. Students tend to assess their place in the world by where they fit into their immediate surroundings, who's with them, where they fit in a family, and where they fit in a classroom. So when you put a group of these students together in a classroom and they're all working at approximately the same level, it's more likely to be a humbling experience for them than to leave them feeling that they're better than other students. Gifted students don't teach themselves, no matter how good they are at reading or math. We had Olympics not too long ago in Beijing. Those people are gifted athletes. They're naturally gifted athletes. But very few of them would be at the Olympics if they didn't have coaching. We have naturally gifted musicians, but very few of them would be playing concerts if they didn't have music teachers. These students, in order to be successful, have to be taught, and they have to be taught at a level that's appropriate to their rate and level of learning where they are. The way to serve these students, we call them best practices, and they're all research-based. Primarily, the most successful are acceleration and advanced classes. Ability grouping is also an important component of services to these students. In the testimony today, further back in your packet, you'll see a bunch of excerpts from letters from families. We have some very satisfied families in Oregon. The ones who are satisfied are primarily those whose children have been accelerated or are in separate ability group programs. The parents whose students are being served simply by classroom differentiation tell me overwhelmingly that their students are not getting anything in the classroom. When we don't provide these options to students, we see potentially very serious social and emotional problems. A lack of fit between what's going on in the classroom and what happens to these students places them at risk. The more gifted they are, the greater the difference is between what they're capable of doing and what they're getting in the classroom, the greater the level of risk. Their risk is of dropping out, but it's more of checking out. They just disengage their mind from where they are. They lose study habits. They forget how to learn. They lose interest in school, and they stop performing in the classroom. Most of them stay in school, but most of them are just simply spinning their wheels there. That means that our tax dollars, which are going to their education, are primarily being wasted because they're not learning anything where they are. I'm here. I will tell you that our failure to address the needs of these kids is a very serious economic problem, but I'll also tell you that I'm here as a mother. And the reason that I got involved in this in the beginning was because I saw emotional damage being done to a large number of children every single day. And their parents came to me and told me the same thing. You'll see some of that in the excerpts I've given to you. Services to high-achieving children is an essential component of our economic development. I was driving down to the hearing this morning. I was listening to the radio, and I heard that Oregon now has lower-than-average state wages. Part of the reason for that is that we have not been investing in our K-12 system the way we need to bring our wage at least up to average and maybe to above average. And until we do that, we are always going to be playing catch-up with our funding. We simply will not, within an income tax state, we will not have the income tax base that we need to support our state services if we don't invest in our income tax payers. I've included in your packet a study by Eric Hanischek. What he did was he looked at the test, the international test, and came up with a scale for comparing countries that were doing well economically with their performance on international tests. And he asked what the role was of test performance and economic growth. He concluded that they're very closely correlated with each other, and he also concluded that you have to both bring a large number of students up to standards. You have to have a base of well-educated people, and you have to also, at the same time, create a smaller group of students to world-class, to very high attainment standards, and both of these are separately correlated with economic growth. You cannot do just one of them and have rapid growth. We are spending a huge amount of time and resources, and properly so, in bringing all students up to basic standards. We have, however, completely forgotten about bringing a high-performing group up to a higher standard. I just received financial figures from the Department of Education from Mr. Allen. You might want to ask him about it a little bit further, but it indicates that school district support for talented and gifted education has actually fallen in real dollars since 1999. So these students are falling farther and farther behind with every single year. There is no federal funding for these students, and there's almost no state funding. There's $350,000 that was appropriated at the special session last year. I've already talked about the need for well-trained teachers. We have a little bit of good news here. The Federal Higher Education Opportunity Act, and I've provided a copy for that act in your packets, will increase requirements for teachers in teacher preparation programs in Oregon. And so I hope that we'll be able to work together to make sure that teachers are, in fact, better prepared to meet the needs of the entire span of their students, including talented and gifted students. That's what the Act says they're supposed to be doing. I'd also like to tell you that our programs here for talented and gifted students lag behind those provided in most other states. The average among reporting states spent on TAG students last time this information was reported was $274 per student. If we funded TAG in this state at that level on a per capita basis, we would be allocating about $22 million per biennium for TAG. That would bring us up to the national average. I also took a look at the advanced placement results a couple of days ago, and we lag the national average in participation in advanced placement in all subject areas, and we lag both in numbers of students taking those tests and in numbers of students getting a 3 or above. But I do have at least a little bit of good news, and actually some of it is here today. Last session, you did work with us to provide us with a full-time TAG specialist. It is really making a huge difference already. We are extremely pleased to have Stacy Figgins on the staff of the Department of Education. I saw her here today. I hope she'll have something to say to you, but we're already hearing from districts that they've been getting information from her. The other thing I want to say is that providing appropriate instruction for these students is not an expensive proposition. We need funding for staff development. We need leadership. But you can provide these services at pretty much the same FTE cost for teachers that we are already having now if you arrange the children differently. If you place the children in classes where the instruction is an appropriate level for them, then we will find that they're learning at a faster pace. There's a lot of research to that. And it really doesn't cost any more to provide an algebra teacher to 30 students than it does to provide a math teacher to 30 students who are 8 grade levels apart in ability. Now, I have here a list of some ways that we can provide services to students at no or low cost and make inroads even in a very difficult session. I also brought you a letter from a 7-year-old. I don't know how many of you have 7-year-olds in your house, but I think just looking at Representative Gilfie has. I think just looking at this letter will tell you that this child is not typical of 7-year-olds. And it would be hard to meet the needs of a child who wrote at this level. To me, it looks more like almost a middle school writing sample. It's hard to meet the needs of a child like this in a regular classroom where you're teaching other children to read. And he says, you know, that the high point of his day is being in the TAG class so that he can learn something new.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Lacey, I know there are a number of other people wanting to talk in the informational hearing, and we have until about 1:35, so just to give you for the total informational hearing.
Thank you very much. I wasn't able to get information from the staff about that, so I have some excerpts from letters that have come in to me. I didn't want to bring you a book, so I just brought excerpts. I think at this point I'll just wrap up and ask you if you have any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Lacey? No, I think you've wowed us with your information, and thank you for all of these materials. I know that we'll be looking at them carefully, and I understand that... Yes, Representative Huffman.
I shouldn't let Margaret get away without acknowledging an email that I received from you recently, and we need to discuss that further, the relationship with the TAG program with school funding, and you were a little harsh on one of my bills that's going to be coming before this committee, and I just wanted on the record that I am the parent of a TAG student from years gone by, but the parent of a lot of other students that were talented and gifted in other ways. And when it comes to the funding situation, we're going to be discussing that before this committee a lot over the next several weeks. But we need to continue the discussion, and maybe we could have Margaret come back and continue that, the needs of the students in relationship to funding. big black hole that we've been discussing even this morning, right?
That's that, how correct you are. Thank you. Are there any further comments or questions for Mr. Lacey? Thank you very, very much. And I understand there are some students here. Jacelyn Nelson, Summer Lake, and Becky Loudon Flores.
You're prepared to speak on House Bill 2518.
Oh, all right. Well, I will call you up when we get to that hearing. I'm so excited to call you that I just couldn't wait until the appropriate time on the agenda. All right, Morgan, please.
Thank you.
Yeah, he should.
Well, thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Morgan Allen from the Department of Education, continuing my consecutive days testifying streak today before your committee. And
can we have you up on Friday as well?
I think it's maybe. I thought so.
I know we've got you next Wednesday. We just really like you.
To warm up the chair.
And joining me today is our new Department of Education tax specialist, Stacy Figgins, who will be talking a little bit about what's been going on since the passage of House Bill 3141. But we'll keep it real brief. We provided some information, just some basic background information for the committee. Back in 1987, the legislature passed the Oregon Talented and Gifted Education Act, and basically it created requirements that public school districts need to identify and serve students who demonstrate evidence of high intellectual abilities or academic talent. And districts are required to provide information to parents about their available services. They're required to allow parent input and discussion for educating those students, and parents also have the right to complain if they don't feel like their talented and gifted students or students of high intellectual abilities are being served well. So we just put a little background information in there for the committee about that. Just a quick high-level overview of what the department does to work with our districts and support TAG programs. We provide technical assistance to schools and districts. We know we're engaging with district schools, parents, and teachers on a daily basis, and we provide curriculum and professional development materials for teachers, and I included the website in the testimony if any of you are interested in looking at any of those materials. We're also responsible for school district compliance. We get quite a few inquiries every year from parents and district personnel in regards to what are the requirements about TAG, and parents who sometimes are concerned that the needs of their students aren't being made, and we investigate and monitor those complaints. There have been a couple of recent ones in Portland and Salem that some of you might be familiar with. We also, as part of the legislation that passed in House Bill 3141 last session, we've restored a couple TAG service centers, one at the Southern Oregon ESD and one at Western Oregon University, to sort of help provide statewide services to TAG programs with a real emphasis on some of the underserved school areas, including some of the rural areas. And then, of course, we work with Ms. DeLacy's organization and lots of other national organizations. So that's just kind of a high-level overview of what we do. A couple things to add to that. We did, when we shared our budget request with the governor this session, the department did ask for $3.2 million and two new staff people to deal with TAG programs and other kids of high intellectual abilities. Obviously, that didn't make the governor's recommended budget in the crunch that we're in, but we continue to try to advocate for those programs at the agency. And then the real thing that happened last session, the legislature for the first time in many, many years passed House Bill 3141, and that authorized the Department of Education to expend up to $350,000 off of the top of the state school fund for TAG programs. And talking to the sponsors, Senator Metzger, Senator Walker, some of the other sponsors in the Senate that really got that language inserted in there, and you know, hearing from the field, essentially what we decided to do with that money was we had about a 0.3 FTE at the department as a TAG person, and so we bumped that up to a full FTE. And then with the remaining money, we put out an RFP and allowed the universities and ESDs to request grants so that they could serve their regions and the state, and again, some of the emphasis on rural areas and provide some of those services. In years past, and Ms. DeLacy would know this better than I do, but a lot of the universities used to have sort of TAG centers at, you know, like Portland State or University of Oregon, and those sort of dried up as talented and gifted funding has dried up over the years. So I'm going to turn it over to Stacy Figgins. We're very excited to have her. She's been on the job for about 5 months. She was a teacher for 12 years and served as a TAG coordinator in the Park Grove School District and the Estacada School District, and she's doing great work for us. And so I was listening to Representative Lewis when we talked about teachable moments, and instead of hearing me drone on, I thought I'd actually bring someone that has some real experience with TAG and could answer some of your questions with me. So thank you.
Thank you, Morgan. Hi, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stacy Figgins, Education Specialist at ODE. I just wanted to highlight some of the projects I've been working on the last few months and answer any questions you might have about that. One of the first things I did was to implement a monthly newsletter focusing on TAG. Several of the content area specialists already do this with English Language Arts, Social Studies, and it seemed a natural fit to add TAG as the next listserv. It's been received very positively by the field, and the membership has grown from around 450 members when I began to over 600 members the last time I checked it. I've had extra time to work on increasing collaboration with different partners like OTAG and university experts in the field of TAG. I've been able to spend a lot of time listening to the needs from the field, the districts, and I've took those needs to heart and research the areas that they've asked me to, and then gone back to them with current updates of things that they've requested. We spent some time in our department reorganizing the ODE TAG website, and we've tried to make it more user-friendly, and we were constantly adding more resources to that website, and I've also included a survey so people can give feedback for things that they'd like to see on there. I've been continuing the monitoring of the corrective action plans in Salem-Keizer and Portland Public Schools. Taken some time to collaborate with ODE data specialists to investigate ways to improve and refine data as it relates to the identification and achievement of TAG students. We have some of those numbers already, but if we could get additional data to look at how those students are doing in the classroom, it would help us to know better where we can give more services. And we have a curriculum document, I don't know if you're familiar with it, it's calling Challenging High-End Learners, and this is a document that started in 2003 and has had subsequent revisions and updates. It's pretty extensive and has a lot of valuable curriculum information in it, and one thing I'll be doing this spring is updating the math and science standards that have been revised with a team of math and science teachers. I'm also very excited about a project that I'm doing right now that will be a statewide professional learning community focusing on cluster grouping models. And I have 53 district administrators and TAG coordinators who've indicated interest from around the state. And I'm providing them with a resource book that we'll be reading together, and we'll have an online cyber discussion around the book and investigating ways that they might be able to implement those models in their schools. It's a pretty cost-effective way of getting at some of the needs of TAG students. Also was able to implement a mini grant to reimburse in-service teachers for taking graduate coursework related to TAG students' needs, and printed new parent brochures and other support documents, and translated the parent brochure into three additional languages. We already had Spanish and Russian, as well as English, and we added Chinese, Vietnamese, and Fanti, which were the next most common languages of origin for students in Oregon. And then finally, I've been collaborating with the TAG Services Centers at Western Oregon University and Southern Oregon ESD to focus on better statewide coverage for professional development for teachers and administrators for TAG students. And I thank you for the opportunity to share with you, and we're here to answer any questions you might have about any of this.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Dimbro.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell us more about the corrective action plans at the two districts and what you're finding, how they're going?
I have more information about Portland Public because they're required to submit quarterly reports. Salem doesn't have that same requirement. So far, based on the first two quarterly reports, Portland Public Schools has met their benchmarks for each quarter that they've set.
Mm-hmm. And what could you just say a little bit about what's involved in those plans?
What are they?
You mean what are the items that
they're working on? Yeah, what's being benchmarked? I mean, what is the problem that's being addressed through the correction?
There are multiple issues, but some of the one that's in common with both districts is focusing on secondary instruction that meets rate and level for TAG students. It's one of the problems that seems to be across both. Portland Public had some issues with equity of access related to students from other cultures. Those are some of the other examples.
Mm-hmm. And so are they doing more outreach to students from other cultures? Is that where they're being successful?
Mm-hmm.
I know that's a concern.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, they didn't have all of their documents translated into other languages, and one thing that they've implemented is in every single school now they have a TAG bulletin board where they have all of the basic information that any parent might need about their programs, and they've included those in other languages.
Mm-hmm. And is it successful? I mean, are they attracting kids from those other cultures into TAG?
I know that they have... I don't have any hard numbers on this identification, but I know that they've been working with those populations, and I'm sure that by the end of the year they will have an increased identification in those subpopulations. It seems that way.
Okay, thanks.
Are there any further questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Representative Pop.
No, Representative Roland was waving down there.
I was just going to ask. But no, I'm okay.
Well, I don't know. Representative Roblin, you can ask a question today.
Thank you very much. I was a little late today.
Just one.
I had another of engagement, and getting here was a harrowing experience. But and I guess what I would like to ask is, are districts around the state looking at your position as the godsend that they should, and asking for ways in which they can help meet the needs of these kids? Are you getting those requests?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Because I love the testimony before. I am a firm believer that it really doesn't have to take a lot more money. It just has to take a mindset. And having someone that can answer those questions and help them, I don't think there's a better way to spend this money to get it started. Because we have all sorts of courses offered in schools. And getting people in the right places is the important issue. And I appreciate what you've done. I've only heard really positive things, so I just wanted to mention that, too, from a lot of different people.
Oh, thank you.
But this is a bigger issue than I think. Most people in this committee kind of know that, but
okay.
For a lot of people out there, they don't understand. But from my perspective, these young people are as different from the mainstream as the people we spend a lot of extra money on.
Mm-hmm.
And their needs are, we have to figure out ways to help them stay engaged in school.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much for coming. And was there anyone else that was here today for the informational hearing on talented and gifted programs? No. Well, thank you all very much for a great presentation, and I will close the informational hearing on talented and gifted programs and open a public hearing on House Bill 2518. Representative Roblin.
Should I go around? I might.
Yeah, why don't you go around?
That'll be good.
Thanks. Hello, stranger.
Hello, for the record.
For the record, will you tell us who you are?
Yes, my name is Arnie Roblin. I am state representative from House District 9. What you see before you is an attempt from after a lot of people talk to me regarding the idea that students should be able to take trips to other parts of this country and to other parts of the world, and that those experiences are very, very important, and that because of the ethics law that we passed last session and the interpretation how it's working, some of these programs are not available to students again. There were a couple other people who have come to me, and because of the relating clause, have some other issues that are here as well with regard to this issue. But and some of it has to do with teachers who provide a service to a university and want to get a stipend and something and so on. And some of those issues also have come up, and I think Ron Burson's here, and he can talk about some of those. I am one of those people, and I mentioned it last time. I don't think it's the problem of the agencies interpreting. I think it's the problem of us writing it correctly. And in this particular bill, during the Rules Committee, I asked a lot of questions about can we write it in such a way that these programs that have schools a lot taking students to other places will still work. And we were moving forward in a fairly rapid pace, and some of the answers we got were correct. And I believe, truthfully, that if school districts were to organize it in certain ways, they could meet the requirements. And we can ask Ron if he believes the same thing. But in final analysis, I don't know how many of you have ever taken a trip to, say, the Capitol with 14 or 15 or 30 middle school students. But I don't see it as a vacation for the teacher that went. And I also don't see it as them getting a benefit or an ethics kind of problem. I see it as very angelic on their part. I was more than happy to send my middle school students off to Washington, D.C. and New York with them for a period of time. It was good for our family and very good for my children. As a high school principal, one of the most important things we do was to invite foreign students to our school who gave a different aspect to our school that could be replicated in no other way. And our kids got to know and make friendships that are lasting a lifetime. And we sent kids the other way. But many people aren't willing to take a whole year and go do that. And so finding opportunities to allow students to have that experience to see another part of the world. And in particular, and I think it's good for every student, but in particular in places like Coos Bay where I was, there are students who never got out of our local community. Their parents didn't have money, they didn't get places, and they would go and work in clubs and raise money, and all of a sudden they had an opportunity that they would never have had in any other way to go see the capital of our country, to go, in our case, we had exchange programs with Germany and with Spain and with England and with the Cook Islands. I believe that those students came back with a different appreciation for learning and a different appreciation for what they might choose to do in their lives. My assistant was one of our students who went to the Cook Islands and helped with some activities that our school did with Cook Island people. And when those students came back and reciprocated, it was truly remarkable to watch the interactions of our young people and those young people. And because of the way this is written, we are denying a group of students the opportunity, I believe. The whole purpose of this bill is to start looking at how do we make it so that it will work. And it's great to see the people who are here who can explain maybe we can make it better. The other thing that I thought was really important that didn't happen last time is that we're letting the policy group, education, have the discussion and ferret out how to best do this. That's why it's here. It will eventually go to rules and be incorporated with other things, and I think that's the way we get the best legislation, which does what we expect it to do without opening bigger loopholes or making other problems, but it is through the open conversation of all of us that make these things the best. And that's why this bill sits before you today. I hope that you will consider it, and I'm pleased to have the people sitting behind who wish to testify as well. So if there's any questions, I would be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Representative. Colleagues, here's your chance. Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is part of a larger process of addressing ethics laws.
Yes.
And this bill will be stuffed into other bills to make essentially an omnibus bill through various policy committees. Is that how you understand?
I'm hopeful that other people will do similarly. And I know that there's a group of people who have amendments to this one that if we move it from here to rules, they will come and we'll have those conversations. I anticipate in rules having real conversations. The bill, the big omnibus bill, is moving to us from the Senate. We are looking at other things that I think may have been overlooked there, so it may go as a separate bill. But my belief is that as we look at these things and find places where we think we can make this law work well and do the things that we anticipated it doing, which is helping all of us and all people have more faith in all of their government, that we'll fix those things that seem to me anomalies and are not helping the situation as this particular issue is. But yes, we will be having open conversations, in my opinion, on and in rules on this ethics bill.
Any further questions for Representative Roblin? Thank you. And just for the folks that are here, we're going to take this hearing until about 2:05 before we move on to the next bill. So next, Jaclyn Nelson, Summer Lake, and Becky Loudon Flores. Welcome. Thank you for coming this afternoon. And before you offer your testimony, if you can just state your name for the record, that would be very helpful.
Yeah,
please.
For the record, my name is Jaclyn Nelson. I wish to introduce my classmates, Summer Lake and Becky Loudon Flores. We're all 8th grade students at Ackerman Middle School in Canby, Oregon, and we're here today to ask for your support on House Bill 2518. Ackerman Middle School has a tradition of offering a variety of field trip experiences for our students. This year, students can participate in a trip to go to South Korea to support our sister school relationship with 2 Korean middle schools, an art study trip to Europe, and a music and band performance to Boise, Idaho, and an American history field trip featuring travel to Washington, D.C., Williamsburg, Virginia, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and New York City. My classmates and I all believe that the travel opportunities such as these enhance learning experience in the classroom, and we think that such opportunities should continue to be offered to students in the future. And we hope the decisions made by the Oregon legislature will make this possible for all students in Oregon. This afternoon, my classmates and I wish to share with you some of our experience from last June when we traveled together on our school's American history field trip. We'll each share some highlights of our learning experience, and I'll get us off to a good start. My name is Jaclyn. I'm an 8th grade student at Ackerman Middle School, and it's an honor being here in front of you all. Today, my main focus is convincing you that the Washington, D.C. trip is one of those once-in-a-lifetime opportunities that everyone should get a chance to experience, including future 7th and 8th graders. I think they should get an equal chance to travel across the states because some people in their lifetime will never have the time and the money to be able to experience this trip on their own. So traveling with the school is a whole lot cheaper, and the fact that you're there with friends who you can share memories and stories with about the trip when you go. My look on the Washington, D.C. trip is that it's an educational learning experience. I personally learned a lot. I had heard a lot about all these places we went to, but learning in person beats learning in a classroom or out of a book anytime. Also, for me, it was the longest time I'd ever been away from my family, and I learned how to manage my money and take care of myself and not need to rely on my parents, because the fact was they weren't there telling me to keep all my stuff packed up so I wouldn't lose it or help remember where I placed my wallet. But mistakes like these are all part of the learning experience, and they're lessons that you're most likely never to forget. So I had a lot of fun visiting places like Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty and the Holocaust Museum and Ground Zero, Times Square, and much more. I've shared all my memories with people that are interested in this trip, and they're so eager and excited to go that they've had their heart set on it since their older brothers or sisters experienced it. I know my sister has, and she's only in 4th grade right now. But it's not just the Washington, D.C. trip. I'm including all field trips Ackerman and many other schools have. Our band and choir trip takes us to Idaho, and it's important for our teacher and the students because Ackerman has always scored high in the competition. We've always placed like 2nd or somewhere close. But our goal was to really work hard on placing 1st this year. I don't know much about our school's band, but I know the choir class has improved 100% from last year, and I know we have a better chance this year on coming in 1st. Another trip that we've had for a long time is the Europe trip. Our art teacher, Mr. Nawson, always looks forward to taking his students on this amazing trip. They get to travel halfway across the world to go to places like Greece and Rome and Italy and a lot of other great countries. But the last trip is our Korea trip through our sister schools program. We get to experience the journey of going to Korea and learning about their culture and lifestyle. And we make new friends and share funny stories. In my opinion, I think both schools benefit from this. My whole point of this testimony is that our field trips are really important to our school, and we love going on them. That's why I'm here in support of House Bill 2518. We don't just learn a lot, but we also have fun, and I want you to see that through our school is the best way to experience these trips. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Summer Lake. I'm a student of Ackerman Middle School, and I was one of the 45 students that went on the Washington, D.C. trip. There are many things that I learned on this trip, but two that stuck out in my mind are the Vietnam Memorial and the Declaration of Independence. The reason they stuck out, these two particular places stuck out, was because they were the most influential and memorable sites and pieces of history that I experienced on this trip. The Vietnam Memorial pays homage to 58,260 people, or servicemen and women who served in Vietnam. Four additional names were added in 2008. I believe it is an important monument because it recognizes all the men and women who served in Vietnam. Almost 3 million Americans served. We also learned that although we were considered a superpower, our strengths, both militarily and financially, were not powerful enough to resolve any conflict that we faced. Our recognition of those honored fighters with such bravery will never be forgotten. The year 1776 made history. On each 4th of July, we celebrate our independence from Great Britain. On the 4th of July, 1776, with the help of Thomas Jefferson, who later became our third president, we announced that the 13 American colonies were now independent states. In the most simple terms, the 4th of July is in essence the United States' birthday. Over time, the Declaration of Independence had garnered a great respect and provided a solid foundation for our country. Human rights that all men are created equal comes from this document. We as humans should all live by the simplest saying, treat others as you want to be treated. This, by the way, is currently on our school's entrance billboard. Because Washington, D.C. houses the most influential document at the National Archives building, we as U.S. citizens and those as visitors from other countries can witness one of the greatest pieces of American history. This declaration was a foundation from the other statements of principles, one of which being the United States Constitution. Our country is broad, our citizens are diverse, and our heritage and history shall always be remembered, practiced, and honored through today's actions of our countrymen and women. These are a few of the things that I learned on our Washington, D.C. trip. There were many others, but I thought that these were the most important to tell you about. I am here to show that my fellow classmates and I learned of much information about our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Thank you.
In the summer of June 2008, students from Ackerman Middle School and Baker Prairie Middle School boarded a plane to start their long journey across the country to our nation's capital and surrounding states. My name is Becky Loudon Flores, and I was one of those students who were on that plane. On this trip, I had no idea what was to be expected. I didn't know exactly what we were seeing there. Most of the things I knew about the stops we were going to make was that they are very old, and someone very important inspired the ideas of most of the places and monuments. Then I realized how valuable and what a powerful impact this trip was when I visited monuments that I only read about in books or what I saw on the Discovery Channel. These monuments became alive, and my teacher told me about the history behind each and every one of them, like who they were created after or when they were built. I actually saw and made history by having the honor of laying a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers at Arlington National Cemetery in Washington, D.C. Three other students and I from Ackerman got to walk down the very steps that the soldiers would walk down every day of the week, 24 hours a day. We stood there and listened to them play taps and then lay the wreath. Never did I know that this huge experience that our school trip offered would change my life. During the whole trip, I saw several different groups of students doing exactly what we are doing on our trips, and I realized that they too were having their lives changed just like us on our trip. Now when I read my history book or watch a program on TV or read the newspaper that the new president laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers, I can say, oh, I saw that, or I touched that, and I did that. Thank you for your time, but please don't take this wonderful feeling and knowledge away from us or another school in Oregon.
We thank you for allowing us to testify this afternoon. We are thrilled to participate in the legislative process, and we encourage you to pass House Bill 2518. At this time, we're prepared to answer any of your questions. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. You were a very well-prepared panel, and I'm envious of your trip. It sounded like a wonderful opportunity and that you saw a lot of wonderful things. Are there questions for this panel?
Representative Dimbro.
Thank you. I have a quick question. I apologize. I had to run out for a quick meeting, and so maybe you've already answered this. But as you reflect back upon your American history field trip, what would you say, what sticks in your memory the most? If you were to point to one thing that you experienced during that trip, what would it be?
Mine was visiting the Vietnam Memorial, because my dad had a brother who died in the Vietnam Memorial, and so to see the wall with all the names on it, and I got to do a rubbing of that and his name, and it's kind of special because my dad's brother was like early 20s when he died, and my dad was really, really young, so we didn't really know much about his brother, and it's kind of like the only thing that he has of his brother right now, and it's like on his desk, and it's kind of special to our family, so...
The stop that would stick in my head would be the Holocaust Museum, because if I would have not been able to go to the museum, I wouldn't have been able to see what happened to all of the people and see the pictures of all the concentration camps and understand how they felt, and it triggered some emotions in me when I was there, and it was just really emotional. It was nice.
Mine was visiting the Arlington National Cemetery and laying the wreath at the tomb. It was special just seeing first the soldiers doing it, and then me actually participating in it was a very special moment that I enjoyed on the trip. And my mom went there before, mm-hmm. and she told me that when she was there, it was a very memorable experience, and that I will have a lot of fun doing it. And the honor of it is just, not able to be said, because it's so honorable that it's hard to just explain to all of you how memorable it was to me.
Well, I'm so glad you all had the opportunity to have those experiences, and I hope we can make sure that other kids have the chance to experience the same kinds of things. Are there any other questions for this panel before we move on to the other witnesses on this bill? No, thank you very much. You did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
So next, could we have Katja Freeborn, Tony Crawford, and Don Deppner, please?
This is not going to be an epic. We're going to figure this one out. There are ways to do it, but the school district has to take responsibility. They have to go into this process.
Welcome.
Thank you. Did you want us to go in a particular order?
You may choose.
This is where we're going to hear that.
Okay. Well, I think I'm speaking, so I guess that implies I'm going.
There's a prize.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the House Education Committee. My name is Tony Crawford, and for the past 29 years, I've been a social studies teacher at Ackerman Middle School in Canby. I might have become a math teacher if I'd had a little different influence at Marshfield High School when I was in math class at that time, but good to see you again. We were much younger back
yes,
then.
Yes, we were.
I'm pleased to be here this afternoon to encourage your support for House Bill 2518. You know, as you review my written testimony, you'll see that for the past 20 years, I have been involved with the Washington, D.C. and East Coast field trip at Ackerman Middle School. It has become a tradition at our school. My first experience as a co-chaperone just made it so clear to me that this was a learning opportunity that we wanted to make sure that all of our students had opportunity to experience. You know, every year when I take students, I always have those aha experiences where students are just awestruck and they'll say something, or, you know, you'll even witness a tear, you know, start to well up in their eye. It's just a wonderful thing to be able to share this kind of experience with my students, and I do hope that we'll be able to continue this tradition that we have started at my middle school. You know, for the past, many years, the organizing and preparing for such field trips has been fairly routine. But in the wake of Senate Bill 10, my world has simply changed, and I might suggest the world of other teachers throughout the state of Oregon just like me. You know, we understand that the changes were simply unintended consequences. But, you know, we have an opportunity to go back and fix what needs to be, you know, fixed, and this is what we look forward to. You know, I do insist that these are exceptional learning opportunities, and we want to be able to maintain them as best we can. The current situation that I face to satisfy the concerns of my own school district, the Canby School District, is that I am asked to put in writing a statement to the parents who consider having their children participate in our field trip, a statement that says that my travel expenses are included in the tuition that's charged for the field trip. Now, for the past 2 years that we've done this, I've received absolutely zero comments or concerns or any statements of belief that this would be an issue for anyone. In fact, the parents kind of go, so, what's the deal? Let's go on to the next agenda item. You know, so not a single parent has expressed concern. You know, and I must also say that, you know, the practice, this practice of having the teacher's travel expense covered with, you know, the tuition that's charged for the participants, it's time honored and it's industry wide, and up until just the recent Oregon Ethics Commission's opinion, things have just been going along just fine. So, you know, again, we're reminded that House Bill 2518 will make the appropriate corrections. I also want to tell you, while I'm explaining to the parents that my tuition or my travel expenses are covered in the tuition, I also go on to tell them that for the week that we are on the road on the East Coast, I receive no compensation. And that's a point that also needs to be made. I'm on no one's payroll. I do not receive a stipend. But I am on duty 24/7. And that includes, you know, the 2 a.m. wake-up calls that I get, you know, to go deal with the sick student or with the stupid boys who still have the television on because they don't know how to go to bed. Girls get a lot more sleep on these trips than the boys do. But, you know, regardless of the lack of sleep that I experience, you know, it's my duty to make sure that each and every one of my students on these field trips has all of their needs met. And so, you know, being there with them, sharing the learning experiences, telling them what I've learned over the 20-plus years that I've been on these trips, you know, and just, you know, being able to share that this is what I live for. It's a great opportunity. One last thing that I would like to comment on is just to bring to your attention that schools and programs such as the one that I represent are not the only casualties of Senate Bill 10. I would like to tell you that we arrange our travel through Educational Travels Services Incorporated from Clackamas, Oregon. They are the only student travel service company in the entire state. And so, you know, because school districts have been discontinuing their field trips, their business has also been hurt. They've been laying people off. You know, and I would dare suggest that if we were to lose this business outright, you know, to lose this service, it would, you know, certainly be critical to Oregon schools and to students. One last thing to mention about ETSI, they are an accredited school. And so what this allows me to do is I teach a companion curriculum, teaching night classes to my students who are going to travel with me, and we prepare for the trip through these night classes, and it allows these students to eventually earn high school credit. So, again, the academic purpose of the trip is reinforced. I do thank you for the opportunity to address the committee this afternoon, and am pleased to respond to any questions that you may have. Do encourage your support for House Bill 2518.
Thank you. And colleagues, I'm going to urge us to hold our questions until the panel is done. And we do have another bill to hear this afternoon. We don't have the fiscal back yet on this bill, so we won't be able to send it on to rules today, so we will be able to revisit it. All right.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Representative Gelster and the House Education Committee. My name is Dawn Deppner, and I am the mother of two students in the Canby School District. And I am here today to ask that you consider amending the current laws and approve House Bill 2518. Current laws jeopardize the opportunity for students to learn outside the classroom and challenge educators as to their ethical standards. I've had the opportunity to attend a Washington, D.C. field trip with an outstanding educator, Tony Crawford, and personally found value in the hands-on approach to learning. As a parent and current PTA, or Parent Teacher Association board member, I would like to take this opportunity to give insight on what I personally feel regarding the paid field trips. Being able to watch my son learn through his eyes was an amazing experience. He was afforded an opportunity to learn hands-on outside of a textbook. This trip gave me the opportunity to have conversations with my son about what he learned, what he saw, touched, and most of all, how our forefathers shaped our nation. Our eyes and hearts were touched when we witnessed the gravesites of our fallen heroes who are laid to rest in the Arlington National Cemetery, and were touched again when we were able to view the wall of the soldiers at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. As a parent, I am thankful that my son had such a wonderful experience learning in this approach. Being able to travel to many valuable U.S. landmarks is appreciated so much more when attending with an educator who has the knowledge and the skills to provide the answers to many questions that are readily needed to the students. The value of this hands-on approach to teaching is priceless, and I would do it again. I think it's unfortunate that educators are being labeled as unethical because their trip is paid for by parents and the funds other than their own wages. I was a part of that meeting 2 years ago when Mr. Crawford actually told the parents that his trip was paid. It wasn't even an issue. We were just thankful he was willing to go with these students to Washington, D.C. As a parent, I'm always scrutinizing the safety and security of all of our field trips. I found this trip to be well organized and structured. Virtually every moment of the day was well planned out, with the students' safety being the priority at all times. I remember going to bed at night in New York City with security guards outside of our doors and feeling a genuine sense of relief. As a PTA board member, I come today to tell you that our board at Ackerman Middle School, located in Canby, Oregon, feels strongly about this field trip. Educational trips enrich our students in a way that cannot be done in the classroom. Our PTA board is committed to financially supporting students who are in need of assistance monetarily. The Ackerman Middle School PTA will continue to offer scholarships and partner with our school and staff to enhance the learning experience on all such field trips. If there was any doubt of any unethical behavior, our board would cease all support. I personally hope that this educational experience can continue for all students in years to come. Thanks for listening and your time and your consideration.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Katya Freeborn. I'm so thankful, Representative Rublin, for bringing this to the floor. I teach German at Aloha High School, and since 1994, I've taken student groups to Germany. My last trip was in 2005, and it's every other year. So in the meantime, I thought it was Senate Bill 50, so in my letter that I gave you, it actually says Senate Bill 50, but it's Senate Bill 10. The Beaverton School District came out in the fall and said there will be no student trips anymore due to the passage of Senate Bill 50. And all of us were up in arms, and we couldn't believe it. What was it all about? Well, the claim was that teachers were being unethical in collecting funds from students to take them overseas. In my letter, it explains that the last time I went, I took kids to Germany for 28 days for a total cost of $1,500. And we received donations from Daimler Chrysler and from Lufthansa. And when I called the Oregon Ethics Commission to ask, you know, how can I possibly continue to do my trip without seeming unethical, they said, well, you have to lay out your whole program at the Ethics Commission, and we'll look it all over, and we'll see if it's ethical or not, and we'll approve or disapprove your trip. And at that point, I realized, I don't think I'm going to go through all that red tape to continue to organize a trip that I spend a month on in my summertime to take these students to Germany. Last time I went, I took 18 students, and each of them paid $1,450, and that included all airfare, all food, all travel, all overnight stays. Of course, it's a family exchange, so they stayed with us in April, and then we stayed with families, the same families in Germany. Because it's a cultural exchange, the United States federal government sends us money, and the federal government of Germany supports our program. And of course, that's how the cost is so low.
And in the Beaverton School District, if I had wanted to continue that program, I would have had to submit all of my documentation to Maureen Wheeler, who is our spokesperson for the district. I wouldn't have been able to have any meetings at school unless I had paid for the rooms to use the school. I wouldn't have been able to hand out any flyers during class time. In fact, I was told I couldn't hand out any flyers during class time. I couldn't talk about the trip during class time, and anything I did would have to be done after hours. And it just reached the point where it was too extreme to continue on my own time to prepare this type of trip. I don't go through a for-profit organization, and so essentially all the work that's done for the trip is done by the teacher. In my letter, it's explained that it's called the German-American Partnership Program. It's a nonprofit organization out of New York, and they solicit the funds for us. But when the Ethics Commission heard that Lufthansa donates money and Daimler Chrysler donates money, it looked like I was getting corporate sponsorship, which of course was a red flag for the Ethics Commission. And so I haven't done a trip since 2005, and when the OEA said that they were working on legislation to help teachers be able to go on trips again without being labeled as unethical, I was so pleased. I found out about a month ago. I was really excited. I started telling my students about it again, and so we're getting ready to go in 2010. So I super appreciate you listening to this and reading through my materials and supporting this bill.
Great. Thank you all very much. And we have only a few more minutes, so if there aren't any burning questions, I'm going to go ahead and call up Dennis Tickerson.
Well, can I make a short statement about the other two that are not coming?
Yes.
Short one.
Yeah. Yes. Go ahead, Representative Robles.
We have a couple other people to testify, and we are going to have this bill back. And the one thing that I wanted to make sure that was said, and since they're not going to be here, is that there's a couple amendments that we need to do. One just says teachers in here. Well, administrators and sometimes classified staff are the people that do this, and we need to expand those things and make sure that happens. And I appreciate COSA recognizing that. Because, as we talked about last time, the words are very important. So, I want to commend them. We'll hear from them a little later. And there's a couple other things with respect to college courses and other things that they want to talk about as well. But that's just a
thank you. And I think that was a prelude. I was getting ready to say I was going to ask Chuck and Ron if we can have you come back since you visit us often. We've got folks who've traveled for the next bill. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. Good to see you. And he could have been a math teacher, too.
Clean it up. Mr. Tickerson? I can't. You have to teach me. Please teach me. Titchener.
I'll just take a minute of your time, Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me here. I am extremely fortunate. I taught middle school for 29 years and travel all over the world with kids. And now I'm a company that is fortunate enough to provide these trips that he mentioned from Clackamas County. We are very much for this, and we really appreciate it, because virtually these trips will come to a standstill. And I have over 100 trips going out, choir trips, band trips, history trips, and all of them are educational-based and safe. That's our primary mission, is to have these kids have a wonderful experience, because that's what I had. And we think it's providing a living classroom for these kids. It's something that they learn, and then they go outside and they actually see it. And you heard these wonderful students testify to that. I think that's all the testimony I'll make. I do have a letter to you from us, but the most important part of that is page 2. It's testimony from a teacher and sisters of how their superintendent interpreted this trip. And by the way, the superintendent, I know, and she's totally for this trip, but she had no other way to interpret it but through the Ethics Committee, and it's his testimony of why his trip has to stop. And every teacher that we have could have this letter. And I urge you to pass this bill and any amendments that you have that will take care of the unintended consequences of a bill that had good intentions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the service that you provide to the kids. And thank you for all of the testimony today. I think clearly everyone here has spoken clearly on the importance of this bill, and to have so many people come out and feel so passionately about it is a real testament to the importance of the bill. So thank you, Representative Roblin, for bringing it before us.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2518, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2362. Representative Kopp.
Chair Gelser and committee colleagues, I will be very brief. My name is Betty Kopp. I serve House District 22, and it's my pleasure to bring a bill forward that is a teaching tool to assist students and teachers to reach the highest levels of academic achievement possible. And this is a tool, it is an assessment, and it's not just a test, but it's a teaching tool where if a student takes this bill will provide, well, the department will have the opportunity to provide this assessment to all students in the state. We heard already in this committee this afternoon about the value of our talented and gifted program. If I was a teacher and I had some of these talented and gifted students, I would say, well, I want to see exactly what your strengths are and areas that you might want to have some improvement in. And so I would administer this assessment. It is an adaptive test. And as students would take this assessment, they would, if the answer is correct, it'll move them to a different level, or if it's the answer is wrong, it'll move them to a different level. And I'm going to let the experts really explain this, but I will just share very briefly the value when a teacher knows exactly what level the student's at so that they can adjust their lessons to help them grow as far as they can. That's the value of this assessment tool. And when I was a principal, my teachers always came to me and they said, because I'd say, what would be the most helpful thing for you to be successful as a teacher? And they would say, an assessment to help me guide my instruction. That's exactly what this does. If you are teaching English, you know exactly the strengths and weaknesses of the students, so you can adjust your lessons for your class and your students. It is a powerful tool, and with that, I would love to have Matt Chapman and Dr. Bob Baker assist in informing you so you can look at what this tool looks like in practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Palm. Please.
And we have a PowerPoint which magically appeared. Technology stuff really works. Thank you, Representative, and Madam Chair and members of the committee. We really, really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. For the past 2 years, I've had the opportunity to lead an organization known as the Northwest Evaluation Association, which is based here in Oregon. I want to address the issues that the Representative Kopp had mentioned, but since I suspect that we are to some extent unknown to the committee, let me, if I may, spend just a moment to let you know who we are, because we have been somewhat invisible. First of all, we are a not-for-profit, and the reason that Northwest Evaluation Association was formed is for the mission of partnering to help all kids learn. And in that area, we are particularly focused on a vision of education that is kid-centric. And one might hope that that would be a very non-controversial issue, and one might hope that that would be something that would just be a given. Unfortunately, in a lot of areas of education, it is not. We have changed a good bit of our focus in education to become far more school-centric and to get away from the real focus that we believe is essential, which is on a child. And in that context, we believe it is essential that there be kid-centric education based on comprehensive and accurate data. And that's what I want to talk about just briefly this afternoon. And the purpose of that is so that every child can achieve his or her optimal learning path. Children are not the same. And we have different, different learning modalities. We have different rates at which we learn. And the result of that is that we would suggest that that needs to be incorporated into instruction. And that's really what this is about. The bill that we're supporting is really about policy. It's not, this isn't going to cost anything anymore or anything. So this is one bill. You don't have to worry about the fiscal impact. This is not affected by the disasters of the economy, and that'll be cleared, we think, shortly. In terms of, basically who are we? We are an international not-for-profit. A bit over 30 years ago, we were formed as a joint venture of the Portland Public Schools and Seattle Public Schools. And a group of remarkably smart folk said, wouldn't it be better if we could find a real way to measure the academic growth of a child and conduct that growth accordingly? That turned out to be a really, really cool idea. In that context, we are a very diverse group, therefore, of educators such as Dr. Baker. We have a lot of very, very skilled high-tech folk as well who create computer adaptive testing, which I'll explain in a moment. And then, a group of policy advocates. So there's a considerable base. Where are we? We're in all 50 states. We partner with about 3,400 school districts across the country. We serve something just about the range of about 4 million children. Our partners include everyone from school districts to Teach for America to KIPP School, charter schools, and on and on. But what you might notice from this Google map is, where aren't we? We have really not been much of a presence in the state of Oregon, which is our home state. Part of that is because a lot of the areas have been handled by the Oregon Department of Education. There's a strong historical connection. A lot of the folks who founded NWEA, as I mentioned, came out of Portland Public Schools. Some moved to our headquarters in Lake Oswego to form NWEA. Some others moved down to Salem and are part of the Oregon DOE. So that's part of it. But part of it, and it's one of the areas that I'm personally committed to, is that as an organization, we have not really brought our resources to our home state. We have not been as involved in areas as I believe we need to be. As a long time, I've spent my life here, and I'm very, very committed to the concept of using the knowledge and resources of NWEA to benefit the state of Oregon as we do all the other places we are. So if you look at it from the standpoint of what we're about, it's computer adaptive assessments. We align to a thing called the RITS score, and I'm going to explain that in just a moment. It is quite analogous to the one used by the state of Oregon. At one time they were the same. They've diverged a little bit, but it's basically that approach. And we also align, and this is where it starts to get very, very powerful, to various other curricula that, in fact, can be used by teachers to figure out how best to work with individual students. We provide professional development. We provide research nationwide. In fact, we are probably the leading authorities, at the risk of sounding bravado, but I would say in the area of growth achievement and closing the achievement gap, the data that is available through Northwest Evaluation Association is certainly among the best in the world. We have over 100 million events that we have in an electronic database that we use to analyze learning patterns, that we use to analyze what works and what does not work in educational areas. And based on that, we have begun a policy in the last 2 years of advocacy in terms of what it is that is going to be best for children. And that's really what brings us today. So that's kind of who we are. The idea behind this bill is really very straightforward. It sets a state policy that encourages computer adaptive testing irrespective of grade level. Now, as I think most of you know, the state of Oregon uses in the OAKS test a computer adaptive test. But the only questions that are permitted in that are questions that occur within the grade level of a given child. So if you have a sixth grader, it is only permitted to ask sixth grade level questions in the course of the state test. That is a function of the federal interpretation of the No Child Left Behind law. And one of the other things we are doing at NWEA is to get that changed. And we are very, very optimistic that that will occur, so that it will no longer be necessary to confine the questions to an individual grade level, and it can really follow the child. As you can see, what happens is, if the child answers the question correctly, the next question is a little harder. If the child answers the question incorrectly, the next question is a little easier, and it then hones in on the child. If the child is performing academically at grade level, that's great, and it works wonderfully. But what happens if you have a child who is performing below grade level? What you can see on the chart, there will be no questions that will really give us any information about that child that will help the teachers and the administrators and the children and the parents to understand, because the questions that would do that are going to be questions that would be below grade level. And so we can, if we permit that, and that's what this bill does, we can then go through and find out what is the academic performance of that individual child. Now, where does it matter? What really changes is this. If we do that, we can then set a program. It's very straightforward. It's done on an individual basis. It's a function of the computer results that will help that individual child reach at least proficiency. And this has been demonstrated time and again. As I say, it's around 4 million children for whom we do this. And we can design for, it's just part of the reports. We can tell the teachers, here are the things that this child needs to work on. Here's what needs to happen in order to get this child where the child needs to be. If we don't address where the child is academically, we're going to do a complete miss on what that child is all about. Similarly, and we heard earlier today, and we really concur and encourage the comments relative to talented and gifted, kids who are performing academically well above the range of the particular grade. What happens to those children? Well, again, if we cannot ask questions that use test items that in fact cover that, we will find no information as to how well that child is doing. So, for example, let's assume that you have a child who is really struggling. We'll go back to that one for a moment. And this child is a fifth grader and, in fact, is operating at a second grade academic level. One of the things that teachers will tell you, and it is absolutely clear in all the research, that in the right situation with the right focus, you can bring that child in just a year from a second grade to a fourth grade in many, many, many instances. But to do that, you have to reach the zone of proximal development for that individual child. You've got to start where the kid is. Otherwise, you don't have the kid's attention, and you don't have any success with the child. But under the current approach, under No Child Left Behind, moving from second to fourth grade in a year would be considered a failure, because the only thing that matters in that context is whether you've met the grade level. And the testing, therefore, has only been about grade level. Similarly, if you have a child who's a fifth grader but is operating at the seventh grade level, but we haven't measured it very well, and that child gets a little bored, and the reality is that many of those children, when they're not addressed accordingly, wind up being in a position where they frankly can be not only turned off, they can be kind of a little bit of a problem in the class and so forth. You could have that child have a bad year and move from an academic performance of seventh grade to sixth grade, and we would, number one, never know. And again, because there is no ability to ask the right questions. So this is not about dumbing down standards at all. It's just the opposite. This is about assuring that the standards that the state sets are in fact achieved, and that we're in a position where we can in fact accomplish that. Now, the whole way that that occurs is based on a very, very sophisticated statistical model. I will not bore you with that, in part because I would probably get it wrong. That would be in the earlier slide, probably. So the process is one, though, when if you look at what's going on, and this is actual data during a time period when we worked with the state of Idaho, and if you look at what happens with a fixed-form test,
That's the line that kind of goes. It's sort of the traditional bell curve looking thing. That's the amount of information you get, and by virtue of that, what you see is that for children below grade level or children above grade level, you learn next to nothing. Those other brackets are the confidence level that is available, and really about all you know is the kid is above or below. You don't know anything about the child. If you look to the line that's near the top, what you see is the kind of information that we can find about the performance of each child if we use computer-adaptive testing and permit the questions to follow the child instead of trying to force everything to a grade-level approach. And again, the confidence levels are very, very high. Teachers can take this information, as can parents and students, and do some absolutely wonderful things in terms of achieving each child's optimal learning path. We can really generate excellence in this context. And one of the things that Ms. DeLacy mentioned that I really want to comment on, because I think it's a great insight, is this is an opportunity for teachers to use differentiated learning, where you work with the children who are at about the same level, you gather them together, and you focus on their particular issues and approaches. Again, the research is absolutely consistent. It is not, I mean, it's really not even debated anymore. That will yield vastly better performance for the children. And then the last thing before I turn it over to Bob to talk just a little bit about how this affects each kid, is I mentioned that this is aligned to the RITS scale. One of the things that we believe is essential, and this is really kind of part of the policy that we're suggesting the state adopt, and I do stress this is not something unique to NWEA. We have many competitors. There are lots of other folks that are in the area of adaptive testing. So this isn't a special purpose for us bill. This is a policy that we think will align the state of Oregon to the very best practices. But if you want to measure growth, what is needed is just that is quite analogous to the way we measure our children to see how much they've physically grown. You create a yardstick, an equal interval linear scale. And the way we do it with our children's physical growth is that you go through and you look and we measure each child, and then a little later you measure the child again. That is the brilliant idea that some folks at Portland Public Schools had over 30 years ago. They could create that kind of a scale. And in the context of that, they did it, and it's been done with phenomenal rigor ever since. So if you look at the scale, the way that we make sure that the rigor continues is that when we ask a question, we test it. And we'll find that there will be a pattern. It almost always looks like this as to how the children are doing. So based upon the RIT levels, the kids who have very low RIT levels on this one are going to get it right, hardly ever, and the kids with high RIT levels will get it right almost all the time. And somewhere in the middle, and again, the science here tells us that it needs to be at the 50% level, what happens is you can then start to draw a pattern, and you look at when the kids are getting it about halfway, and that tells us that the RIT level here is about 170. The reason I say that is, again, to the concept of comprehensive and accurate data. This is, I won't go into any further detail on it unless you have questions, but the point I want to draw is these are things that are done using combinations of psychometrics. Actually, I think it is the case at NWEA that we employ more psychometricians than probably anybody in the world. That means we have really great assessments and very boring parties. But the process is one in which this technology works. This was designed 40, 50, 60 years ago in terms of the psychometrics behind it and the approach RIT stands for Roche Unit. And the process is one that is absolutely completely valid. But because of the policies in place and the focus on grade level, we are in a situation where we are really hamstringing the capabilities of our teachers, our students, and our parents to learn what is going on. And this bill would change the policy and make it a policy that says we're going to find out about each individual child, whether that child is at grade level, below grade level, and above grade level. And given that information, we're going to do whatever we need to do to assure that that child achieves excellence. With that, let me turn it over to Bob, and I'll play.
Thank you, Matt. Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, I would like to echo Matt's thanks in giving us the opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 2362. My name is Bob Baker, I am currently the Director of State Relations for NWEA. I've been a lifetime educator, many years as a special education teacher, many years as a third grade teacher, and many years as a elementary school principal in Indiana, the Hoosier State.
Where at in Indiana?
I was in a school in Franklin, Indiana, which is just south of Indianapolis.
I know Franklin.
Do you know where that is?
I do.
Franklin
I do.
College, yes. What you see on the screen is what a student sees after they finish completing the last item on the test. They get instant scores, instant feedback. Daniel has a mathematics score of 201. You would generally consider Daniel a very, very good math student with that score. However, we also provide data in goal areas beneath the general subject. And if you were to look at Daniel's score, you would see that according to the sub-goals, he performs very well in certain areas under math and poorly in other areas. You notice that he's very strong in the area of number sense and geometry, but performing very poorly in estimation.
Can you push the microphone just a little? We're getting a lot of feedback.
Sure.
No, the other way.
The other way.
Away.
Away from you.
Away. Okay.
Away. Perfect. Thank you.
I'm sorry. He's performing very poorly in the area of measurement. This tells a teacher a lot. It's one thing to say that a math student has strong math skills, but with all students, they are all on different levels, as Matt had alluded to. So this teacher would have the data necessary to inform his or her instruction. I'd like to demonstrate one of the educational reports that we provide for teachers to show you where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, where we go from data and then using that data to actually inform the instruction for the level that child is at. First, you see that we have a report that groups students by 10-point RIT bands by the general subject. If a teacher then on the reports, their secure reports website, would then click on mathematics, then you would see that it also links down to the individual goal areas. For instance, in number sense, Daniel's performing at the 181 to 190 level. So we click on Daniel's name in number sense, and that will take us to the Descartes. Matt? Right there. Thank you. Descartes is a continuum of learning. In our test, in our test banks, we have approximately 22,000 items. Each item is calibrated to the RIT score, the RIT scale. I'm sorry. So each item represents a RIT score. We use all the information from these thousands of items to build this continuum of learning that we have called Descartes. You notice that it links down to a document that represents number sense skills in the RIT range of 181 to 190. This middle column represents the instructional level for Daniel in that goal area. It's filled with learning statements that are appropriate for Daniel's instruction at that time because it represents his actual level of learning or the zone of proximal development, as Matt mentioned. In this column, in the middle column, represents what a student knows probably 50% of the time. In the previous column, the 171 to 180 range represents material that the student knows approximately 85 to 90% of the time. And in the far right column is the next RIT level, which gives the teacher and the student an idea of what skills are coming up as soon as the skills in the middle column are mastered. Okay? This shows you more of what an actual full page will show you, showing all three levels. The thing to note is that teachers, when first presented with this data, it's really called actionable data because it's data that you can take action on. And teachers sometimes get overwhelmed when they see that they have so many students on so many different levels within their classroom. That's why NWEA is a strong proponent of differentiating instruction. One of the differentiated instruction techniques that we really adhere to is flexibly grouping students for instruction among the grade level or even between grade levels. So it's kind of a divide and conquer sort of thing, so that students are getting the instruction that they need at their actual zone of proximal development. What we have found in a lot of our research and what I see as I travel the country is that students who receive the instruction at this level take off like a rocket, as Matt referred to. The reason that is because they are presented with material that they understand. Students who are low performing and are taught with grade level standards don't understand what is being talked about. An example could be a fifth grade state standard in mathematics could be multiplying and dividing fractions. Well, there are some students coming into that fifth grade classroom who know how to shade in half a circle, and that's all they know about fractions. So a teacher has to go to that level to teach the child, and that student more than likely will make at least 2 years growth in the area of understanding fractions. The last thing I wanted to talk to is about providing the instructional piece. We have the curriculum piece in Descartes, and we have the assessment piece with math. The instructional piece, for Compass Learning as an example, is illustrative of the partnerships that we're currently working on with instructional providers. So in other words, as an example, Compass Learning would be receiving the RIT data for each student, and the teacher would then get a learning package or activities, lesson plans, worksheets, etc., at that student's instructional level to help him or her inform that instruction for that individual student.
Okay. Thank you. And with that, we'd be delighted to answer any questions you may have. But again, the idea behind this is in the context of having a state policy that says that we are going to be kid-centric, we're going to find out where every child is, and we're going to provide the information that students, teachers, and children can use to assure the maximum ability of that child, recognizing the differences that children have, not only in the speed at which they learn, but the learning modalities and the whole thing. We think this is a policy that will help Oregon in a goal that so many of us share of making sure that we actually achieve excellence in our schools. So this is not about, you know, any given organization. Our competitors could come up, and obviously their products aren't nearly as good, but they are there. This is about a philosophy of education to really focus in on our children as individuals.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation. What questions are there for this panel? I'm sure there's many.
Ma'am?
President Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, what was the purpose of testing back in the 19th century?
An interesting question, because the purposes of testing have gone through quite a variety of changes. In the 19th century, it was to find out whether or not somebody knew, in many instances, enough to become a citizen. That was one of the goals for testing. There was testing that was involved to ascertain whether people had certain skills necessary to a given job, which was another purpose in testing. There was if you go back to Horace Mann and the...
If we can, focus on it within the realm of education.
Within the realm of education, it was to find out if they had mastered the particular topic that was being taught, whether it's, you know, spelling, math, whatever.
And the purpose of the 21st education testing model is, or should be?
There are two purposes now, and actually that yields a, that I think you're getting at an incredibly important and positive point. We still need, and there's nothing in this that would back away from the absolute requirement to test to find out whether somebody has adequate mastery. It's sometimes called summative testing is the term, or accountability testing. Did the kid learn what the kid needs to learn to be, you know, to pass the eighth grade, to get a high school diploma? That testing is essential, and that can be done as part of what we're talking about as well. But in addition to that, what we've now found is that a purpose of testing that can really help the quality of learning is to find out the rate of growth and the amount of growth that is occurring within a, for an individual, either child or group of children. So there are now more purposes to testing that are available in what is often called formative or interim testing that allows us to measure how well children are growing. And so both purposes are utterly essential.
Well,
and I mean, this is fascinating. In fact, Representative Comp and I some time ago had a conversation about this, and this is what testing should be about. That, you know, the old way we took tests was we took the test and we either passed or we failed, and the teacher said, "Huh, okay," and then you moved on to the next subject.
Right.
And it should be actionable information that can be individualized to the student so that we can address shortfalls and tag instances, you know, that people that exceed, and move on. The problem I see today with our education model is it is extremely difficult to do that when you have a teacher and 30 students or 20 students, whatever number, without having the ability, quite frankly, with technology, to individually adapt the delivery, or not the modality, but the delivery of the information and the quantity and the speed and everything else. So this is significant stuff, and I appreciate the efforts and I appreciate this being brought forward.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a fiscal impact to this that we have an assessment of at this point?
Representative Harker, one of the reasons we pushed this to the second item on the agenda, we were hoping to get the fiscal impact statement back today. If the fiscal impact statement is as we expect at zero or indeterminate, we will be able to request that the referral to Ways and Means be rescinded and we can move it to the floor. But this really is offering an option.
Yeah. It seems, thank you. Follow-up? Redirection?
Absolutely.
Thanks for the info. It seems, we concur again. And it seems to me that this is a better option of the testing that than has been described as what's going on now. Is it a more costly option?
Interestingly enough, one of the things Oregon has done is pioneer the use of computerized testing. And so we have better data in our state than any place else. The interesting answer is it costs all in all dramatically less, not just a little less. The reason for this is that it is our belief, and there is a little controversy on the following, so I want to be very candid with the group, but not much. It is our belief that you can provide in the same test the answer to multiple questions. So if, for example, we are measuring whether a child is operating at the fifth grade level because the child's a fifth grader, and we find that the child is operating at the seventh grade level, we would argue we have answered the question of whether the child has operated at the fifth grade level. Or to phrase it differently, if I can prove to you that I'm in San Francisco, I think I have also demonstrated I'm not in Portland. And the process is one where there are multiple uses. That, interestingly enough, there are a number of people who disagree with that. By virtue of doing that, two things happen. One is that it is possible to use the same assessment process for multiple purposes, and therefore there are fewer assessments that would potentially be needed. Mm-hmm. A lot of work to be done on that, but we believe that to be the case. We are engaged in a pilot right now in the state of Utah, where they are, in fact, very anxious to proceed on these lines, and they are working with us on creating we are creating for them a test that will demonstrate that ability. It's some of what we did for a period of time in the state of the state of Idaho. So there's that aspect. The other thing about it is that it costs a ton less to grade a computer adaptive test. And remember, it's done as soon as the kids it's done. The slide that that Bob showed earlier, let me just move that, just because I think this is just compelling, so bear with me for a second. That's what the student sees as soon as the test is done. It's graded. And if you look at non-computer adaptive, or you look worse yet at paper pencil, you've got to send it through to the Scantron machine to be in a position to have it run through. Somebody's got to go through all these processes. The cost of that is absolutely dramatic. So if we really look at this, the great irony we would suggest is not only is there more information that is actionable, that we can really use to make the teaching better, there is also a potential for very material savings when you look at the systems cost of assessment, and also when you look at the amount of time that gets away from instruction because it needs to be used for assessment.
Thank you.
Representative Dimbrough.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You know, the everything you're saying is very, very exciting, and you know, I think it just has great, great potential to do great things. It also has potential to do nothing if the teachers and the schools don't really know how to use it, mm-hmm. and how to use it to its best advantage. So I'm wondering if this kind of testing is being exposed to teachers in the schools, school of ed, you know, in the schools of education, in their testing curriculum, and I mean, are teachers, you know, ready and willing to use this kind of technology, and it's just that they don't have the means to do so.
Two answers on that. One is we have ourselves and others a tremendous effort in terms of professional development for teachers, and so when we work with a district, they also receive a tremendous amount of training in both, you know, the simple part, which is reading the reports, and then also how do you turn that into something actionable. The other initiative that we have going, which I'm frankly very excited about, is conversations with the National Council of Teachers of Education. And Dr. I think Sharon Robinson, who is frankly one of the really impressive people in the whole area of education. She was actually in the very short list for being Secretary of Education. She understands the importance of this, and she has sponsored us at their conference to talk about these areas, and we are in the process of putting those conversations together. So the answer is not yet as to colleges of education, but it's a very high priority and one where the kinds of things that Bob and I have been talking about are very, very well received in terms of these areas. So we're very optimistic that's going to get there.
And there are many university professors who contact us and want to know more about our assessment in order to teach potential teachers on how to use data to effectively inform instruction.
Right.
One example I can give for that was at Franklin College when I was a principal. If you remember the Google Earth, Indiana is saturated with NWEA. Probably more than two-thirds of the districts in Indiana use us. And so most of the teachers who graduated from Franklin College went on to teach in a Franklin or in an Indiana district. So they asked me to come and do seminars on NWEA data, helping teachers understand how to use that data to inform the instruction. And there's things like that that are going on all across the country.
Thank you. Representative Comp.
Just a comment. I was really honored to be part of a curriculum team about 15 years ago, and when NWEA was having an impact in Oregon, and our school district used a form of this type of assessment, and then came No Child Left Behind and just a summative assessment. And as was presented, it takes both pieces are very valuable, and I just appreciate the work that this organization continues to do, even though Oregon got left behind in the No Child Left Behind Act on this piece. So
it's pretty powerful stuff. Well, thank you, Representative Kopp, for bringing this bill. Colleagues, this bill, I believe that we are going to be able to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We've already had an initial discussion with the Speaker's office pending that official word from the Legislative Fiscal Office. We have a very, very full calendar on Friday where we're going to struggle to get everything in by 3. Are people comfortable enough with this that I can hold it over for a work session? Is there an interest in moving this relatively quickly, or does it need more time?
I think it can be quickly, but I'd rather hold it over and then I ask some questions and look into some things. Because I was going to, there was one question I had, actually.
Oh, please, Representative Coughlin.
The way it's written right now, it's a may to use this deal, and it gives the opportunity. And I am one of those people who, back 15 years ago, we were going in this direction before No Child Left Behind came about. And No Child basically eliminated our use because we went off on our own opportunities to do the testing with the state. So I guess if No Child went away and we passed this bill, would it be our only testing stuff left? I mean, it would become a lot easier even without, for sure.
Well, we think that they're that these are the reason it's a may in terms of our suggestions to the committee and to Representative Comp is because we think that these are issues where the Oregon Department of Education needs to weigh in, and also areas where individual districts need to weigh in. So we are not big proponents of must. However, what I would suggest is this: we believe, and in fact, we have a bill in the federal House as well. The guys back in D.C., which is House Bill 655 back there, which is co-sponsored. It's a bipartisan bill, and Congressman Wu is one of the key sponsors of this and such. Where it's always, as you folks know better than anybody, predicting legislation would indicate that I would be an idiot. And also, I won't do that, but we are not without cause for optimism. Secretary Duncan is very familiar with what we do. We have had great success in Chicago public schools, particularly some of the charter schools, the KIPP schools that he has there, and some of the other special programs. We are hopeful that we will be able to get him to change some of this by administrative. The reason I mention that is I think it's very germane to your question, and is that if the federal policy changed, it is only a matter of the way that Secretary Spellings and her group chose to interpret No Child Left Behind that made everything fixated on grade level. It doesn't have to be. There's nothing in the law. There's nothing actually even in the regs. It's the interpretation. So when the state of Oregon sought to do computer adaptive testing, one of the conditions, no, one, they didn't like computer adaptive testing to start with, and one of the conditions, as I understand it, was that it could only be within grade level. So if that constraint went away, then I think the Oregon Department of Education would have its, it would be in a position to make appropriate decisions as to what's best, and obviously the legislature would no doubt be involved in that at some level, but it would free up this type of an approach. And then the question becomes, what is the confidence level relative to different kinds of tests? We believe that the evidence is compelling, that you can answer multiple issues with the same sets of questions. You folks do it all the time in polling. If you look at polling your constituencies, you can answer multiple aspects of what constituents think with the same poll. You don't have to use multiple polls. Students, for that purpose, are no different. And we can answer the questions of formative instructional growth at the same time that we answer the questions with respect to whether or not they've achieved the state standards required for meeting a particular summative approach.
Thank you. Any further questions? So it sounds like then we're not going to hold this over for Friday.
Oh, no, I'm saying we could.
Oh, you are comfortable with doing that. Okay, then I'm going to hold open that, or I'm going to hold roll over the work session on House Bill 2362 until next Friday. Unless, was there anyone else that was here to be heard on House Bill 2362? No, seeing none. Then it's held over until Friday. Do I need to open the work session to do that first? Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm on House Bill 2362. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2362, and I'm holding over House Bill 2362 until Friday, February 20th. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2362. And any announcements? and the House Committee on Education is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.